But first, Ginny Hogan. She's a writer and a stand-up comedian. There's an old saying in comedy that you shouldn't quit your day job, but that's just what Ginny did. Now she's a rising star in satire. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and Vulture. Ginny's first book is out. It's called Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. In the book, she humorously explores the gender dynamics and challenges women face in the office. Beta's J. Carlisle Larson sat down to talk to Ginny about her book, her career path, and that day job she left.
I used to be an engineer, and the type of engineer I was a female engineer. That was my job title, and my job security. I don't mean to brag, but my coworkers thought I was very funny. They used to make this joke all the time because I was very lazy, and I would be like, I can't get fired. You can't fire female engineers. And I got called into HR one time, and the HR guy was like, Ginny, people are very upset about that joke. And I was like, look, the timing's not perfect. I need to work out the wording. I'll take it to open mics. But he was like, no, people find it offensive. And I was like, okay, am I going to get fired? And he was like, no, we don't fire female engineers.
You began your career as a data scientist in San Francisco. Not always the biggest leap from data scientist to comedy. How did you get from here to there?
I was working as a data scientist at a financial tech startup in San Francisco, and I was pretty bored, so I took a stand-up comedy class. I had been running this blog that was... It was like ostensibly a data blog, but basically I just used it to make jokes about online dating. So I thought maybe stand-up would be like another way to get into comedy. But I really just thought it was going to like entertain me for a few months or so while I was bored at work. But I got very hooked on it. And from there, I kept doing stand-up. And then I eventually quit my job and started writing freelance.
I like that instead of doing what most people do when they're bored, which is just watch TV or shop online, and I'm talking about myself, you decided to do something slightly more productive, which is do something creative. Do you consider yourself, were you like a creative teenager before you got into tech, or was this something that kind of happened naturally from this blog that you had to write?
Yeah, I think I was pretty into sort of like the art of speaking as a teenager. I was very into my high school like speech team, and I liked the idea of trying to write something that was as condensed as possible, which I feel like is a lot of humor writing. But the humor side, definitely, I didn't really get into until like I was probably like 23 or so when I started writing this blog. So I got into it as an adult. But I definitely had that like passion for speaking publicly, which is good for stand-ups.
And you're really active on Twitter, which is a pretty condensed form of humor. How do you use that as an outlet a lot of the time? Because there are a lot of comedians on Twitter.
I love Twitter, and I originally started using it almost as like a practice for my stand-up bits, or if I had a joke that I thought I might put in a satire piece, but I wasn't sure if it would work. But then it kind of became its own, like an end in itself. I got very hooked on it, and it's so fun to just like get immediate feedback on jokes and to sort of be able to use so many different forms. Like people, I mean, Twitter is like text-based, but you can do like videos and photos, and there's just so much different stuff. And all the memes are always taking different forms and everything. I just feel like it's like kind of constantly evolving, and you can make jokes in many different ways.
And I do want to get back to Twitter in just a little bit, but I want to look at how you got into comedy writing. And the first thing that you submitted was accepted by McSweeney's, which is a pretty big deal. Did you at the time know how big of a deal it was?
Yeah, I actually really didn't. And I, after that, had so many rejections from McSweeney's that I realized kind of that it was... The piece I submitted at first actually was sort of an offshoot of the data blog that I had mm-hmm. been running. It was like a statistical analysis of my happy birthday posts. and I had just quit my job and kind of had a lot of free time, and I was looking up humor blogs I could submit to, basically. But I feel I'm like very grateful that that piece got accepted, or I don't think I would have thought of writing satire as like a good option base. Or I guess I was doing stand-up already, and I kind of wanted to do something else in comedy, but I didn't know exactly what it would be. And I think if not for that piece, I probably wouldn't have decided that satire was like a good route to go down.
you are in good company, both in the rejections and in the successes. So, you know, a good example of that is that piece for The New Yorker you did, The Examples of Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. It's now a book, but it did start as, you know, a piece for The New Yorker. How did you decide to, you know, what was the genesis of that piece?
The way The New Yorker's submission works is that you have to submit through an open inbox for a while, and they'll take like 3 to 4 months getting back to you. And I had just gotten an email from the editor, and she had said that the piece had been rejected, but she said I could submit straight to her, which meant it was going to kind of go a lot faster. So I kind of wanted something like very fresh. And it was at the beginning of the Me Too movement, and everyone was talking about toxic masculinity. So I made a reference to toxic femininity in conversation with a friend. And then I thought maybe I could try to, like, heighten it and turn it into a satire piece. But it was definitely one of the earlier ones that I wrote. But I spent a really long time on it because I thought it could be, like, based on the timing of the last rejection I'd gotten from The New Yorker, I thought it could be, like, a good opening.
You know, when this came out, did you hear from people saying, oh, my gosh, I've had that experience, but it didn't go naturally that way, but it still feels like I really identify with this?
Yeah, definitely. I think the one that there are a few that people definitely like reference a lot. The one about kind of getting spoken over in meetings, I think there's a blurb about how like a woman gets or the one time she doesn't get spoken over, she doesn't actually have anything to say. And that one really like came from like very specific instances that I had in meetings where I was on this team at this financial tech startup, and it was like basically like 20 men and me. And I was so used to no one even like listening if I were to try to talk in meetings that I just basically stopped paying attention. And there was one time when the CTO like turned and asked me directly what I thought. And it was after like 2 years at this company, and I just had been paying no attention at all. So that I think like resonated with people, and definitely people like, kind of logically, what would happen if a company was all women is obviously like it's not supposed to be a suggestion that we shouldn't have men in the workplace or whatever. But I think there are a lot of women who are working with a lot of men and sort of like to think about the idea of having more women on their team, basically, just because it could be like kind of a more amicable workplace for them.
I used to work with all men. It was like me and 20 men. And my friends used to ask like, oh, you must get hit on all the time. You work with all men. But the truth is that if you're in a group of people that's like 70% men, 30% women, the women get hit on all the time. If it's almost 100% men, the men just behave as if there are no women. At least that's what I told myself.
So let's talk about the book, which was sort of a jumping off point from your piece in The New Yorker. How did you approach expanding this out?
It was like a really fun process. I was contacted by an editor at HarperCollins, and she wanted to talk about kind of what direction she thought a book could take of this form. And there were kind of like a few different directions we were looking at first, whether it would be sort of more personal essays and kind of like more serious stories of times I had in tech. But I love humor writing, and that's definitely what I had the most background in. And I had many ideas for sort of separate pieces that could be in a book like this. So we decided on doing a humor book of basically like short satirical pieces for women in the workplace. So from there, we basically started brainstorming what the pieces in the book would be and how many there would be. I worked with an illustrator. She was really great and kind of figuring out like which pieces would have illustrations, what forms the illustrations would take. There are some pieces that are more heavily illustrated, so sometimes the joke is in the illustrations as well. And it was all like a really fun process to figure out kind of what format the book would take.
When you were writing this book, some of, you know, the essays they're funny, but they're also a little bit dark. I would say that the piece about being noise-canceling headphones might have some resonance with some people. You know, how do you find the balance between acknowledging some really messed up work dynamics plus humor here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the noise-canceling headphones, that definitely came out of at my job, I had noise-canceling headphones, and people were always sort of like rubbing, not always, but it happened on several occasions that someone was like kind of rubbing my back, and there was really no reason to. The noise-canceling headphones didn't even really work, so if they had just said my name, I would have heard them. So I wanted it to be, I mean, I think the subject matter is dark, and I think sexism in the workplace is dark, so I definitely didn't want it to be entirely lighthearted. I guess in terms of figuring out, like, how to balance it. I think it's always important to keep in mind sort of who I'm making fun of at any given point. So as long as the person who, like, in the headphone piece, as long as the target of the joke is the person who's kind of behaving inappropriately and who's touching someone just because they have noise-canceling headphones on, I think that's sort of the goal to always keep in mind, rather than trying to make, at any point, make, like, the woman the target of the joke.
I hesitate to ask this question. I'm just curious, given that part of what we've been talking about is, you know, your experience in the tech world, and that being a really gendered place, and, you know, stand-up still has kind of a reputation of being a little bit of a boys' club. Have you run into any, not resistance necessarily, but have you found it sometimes a little weird breaking in, or have you, you know, had an okay time trying to make that jump?
Yeah, I think it's a very challenging environment. To write for a website or a magazine, you don't have to really go out and interface with someone who might be, like, sexually harassing you, whereas in stand-up, you often do. So in stand-up, you have to kind of go to open mics, and anyone is allowed to go, and there's no oversight. It's pretty hard to kick someone out of doing stand-up, so there are a lot of, like, people who make it a very negative environment for women. I mean, there are so many funny women, and I think that there's, like, kind of a growing demand for them, and that it no longer feels like someone is being sectioned off as being, like, a female comedian, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I think that a lot of these women have very general appeal. So I think that, yeah, I would say I'm, like, optimistic about the future. I think for someone starting out in stand-up, and the way that people at, like, open mics or small shows with newer comedians behave around their other comedians could definitely be improved upon, because I think that that's sort of where there's absolutely no oversight. And I think a lot of women probably drop off early because of having, like, negative experiences before they've gotten any traction. Whereas someone who's further along might have a very negative experience with a comedian who is harassing them in some way, but they have already invested so much time and made progress, so they are kind of more willing to keep going forward.
Now that you are doing this full time, you're submitting freelance pieces, you're doing stand-up, you know, what do you see as kind of your course here moving forward? What is it that you want to be doing now more that you have time to actually do it?
I really want to be a humor writer in any capacity, pretty much. I definitely want to write more books. I'd love to write novels, and I'd love to write additional humor books. When I started in stand-up, I had kind of a very narrow career goal, or there were only a few different paths I saw forward, whereas now I think my goal is to just create stuff that's funny and feels true to my voice, and I'm happy to write for other people's shows. I also have ideas for, like, shows I'd want to create myself. But yeah, any sort of, like, humor writing is kind of what I want to do in the future.
Yeah, and as we spoke about a little bit earlier, you are very active on Twitter. It's where you kind of workshop a lot of your jokes. And you're also really open about things going on in your life on Twitter with sort of a humorous bent. Have you found that has resonated with, I guess, Twitter citizens in many ways?
I think for me, a big part of comedy has been that I'm no longer embarrassed to talk about things I used to be embarrassed to talk about. So Twitter kind of represents, like, I don't really feel like there's any reason I should be hiding, like, the way I feel about a lot of things. Like, I don't have any desire to, like, hide my political views or, like, hide my kind of any sort of, like, mental health issues. So Twitter definitely, like, if I can think of a joke on a subject, there aren't that many subjects I think of as being off limits.
Katie Holmes comes in. Robbie and smoothie bar. She orders three of the same kind of smoothie. She sips all three of them, and then she throws two of them away, even though they all taste exactly the same. Isn't that wild? Like, can you imagine being so crazy that you can imagine, so crazy that you dig through the trash for Katie Holmes's rejected smoothies? Seriously, I could not taste the difference, you know? Like, what does she know that I don't know? It must be some sort of Scientology thing.
It would only be off limits if it were about someone else. As long as it's personal to me, I feel like I am pretty willing to share it.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Jenny Hogan is a writer, stand-up comedian, and the author of Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. She talked with Beta's J. Carlisle Larson. Find out more about Jenny at our workplace, wpr.org/beta.
Personally, I have always had a genuine fear and concern about what happens after you die, shared with probably every other member of my species.
Filmmaker Don Coscarelli joins us to talk about his indie horror film, Phantasm. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.